So today we're going to be sitting down with some people from a graduate student group at Harvard called Science in the News. We'll be talking about science communication. We do some communicating of our own, but they actually taught me a lot.
Yeah, no, it was super interesting to hear from other people in the scientific communications community.
Yeah, and these guys do a bit different form of science communication than we do. So we're normally talking to other scientists on the Agene blog or on our educational pages. These guys are trying to communicate with non-scientists. If you do science communication of any type, often you have to communicate as if you're communicating to non-scientists because there's so many different topics in the world of science. I'm learning new stuff every day.
And Tyler, if I'm not mistaken, you used to be a part of this Science of the News group?
Yeah, so I actually used to edit their newsletter, which at the time was called Signal to Noise, but now it's just the Science of the News blog, I guess. But yeah, it's working with them is kind of how I got my job here.
Now, was their podcast around while you were there?
No, people had kicked around the idea of doing a podcast for a while I was there, but as you know, it's definitely a lot of work to get a podcast up and running and to get the people behind it to work together and find people to interview just to keep things going. It's called Sit and Listen, if anybody wants to hear it.
Also, they'll be doing a podcast where they're interviewing you and our outreach scientist, Jess, here at Agene.
Yeah, so they talked to us a bit about kind of our career paths and how open science and science communication impact our jobs here. I don't know if they're going to be doing a full podcast just with us, but I'm excited to see what they'll be putting out. So yeah, that's enough from us, I guess. Let's hear a little bit more from Science in the News. Effective science communication is required to promote public support for research and to keep useful discoveries coming. At Agene, we're huge supporters of science communication. To help you think about ways to effectively communicate your science, we sat down with Vinnie Money and Amy Gilson from Science in the News, a graduate student organization that works to promote science communication. Science in the News hosts talks, a blog, conferences, and more for non-scientists. These programs are all run and organized by graduate student researchers. That's right, hashtag actual living scientists, eager to communicate their science. In this first half of our two-part interview with Vinnie and Amy, we'll discuss the types of programs SITN runs and learn how they think about communicating science. All right, so here we have Vinnie Money and Amy Gilson from Science in the News over at Harvard University. So thank you guys for taking a second to sit down and talk with us. And it would be great if you guys could just introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about what Science in the News does.
All right, so I'll go first. My name is Vinnie. I'm a graduate student in the immunology program at Harvard. I study how immune cells communicate with each other and how we can harness those communications to make better vaccines and immunotherapies. And I've been involved with Science in the News for the past 4.5 years, and we recently started this podcast. We're really excited about it.
Yes, we are. And I'm Amy Gilson. I just defended a week ago, as of the day we're recording this, my dissertation, so now I'm Dr. Gilson. And my my doctoral program was chemical physics, but really what I was studying was evolution, specifically how proteins, which are the molecules genes encode, evolve over billions of years. And like Vinny, I've been involved in SITN since the beginning, since I came to graduate school 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, so you guys have been talking about SITN a little bit. What exactly is SITN?
So Science in the News is a graduate student organization at Harvard that's been around for almost 18 years, so it's almost an adult by itself. You can take out that corny joke later if you want to.
Oh, no, it's...
So SITN has been around for quite a while. It originally started with the goal of just communicating science to the general public, and this started out as a lecture series where graduate students would deliver lectures on a topic of their choice to the public in Boston, a very science-interested public. But I think over the years, we've also morphed into a secondary but a rather important goal, which is training the next generation of scientists to be effective communicators and also to interface with people that are non-scientists as they go throughout their daily lives.
So in addition to the lecture series, we also host science cafes called Science by the Pint, which we host in bars around Cambridge and Boston. And for those, professors come with his or her graduate students and chat with the people who are there about their work, field questions. We also have, what else do we have? We have the SITN blog, which Tyler used to be the editor-in-chief of, which is a really good resource for people who are interested in particular science topics. So one of our top stories is, why do you get colds in the winter? And why do you get the flu in the winter more often than in the summer?
What would you say, individually, the most difficult thing you've ever had to explain to a lay audience is, and how did you do it?
For me, The funny thing is that it was actually the details of my own research in the lab. So it's always easy, I find, to talk when I say, okay, I'm talking about how I'm studying how immune cells communicate with each other and how we can harness that to make better vaccines. But how do I talk about the details of my own research, my very basic science research, and make that accessible to an audience? I think that has been, that was the most challenging because...
You're in the weeds, right?
I'm in the weeds. Like, I have something that is, like, medically relevant, right? And biomedically relevant, and people could be interested in it, but finding a way to get them excited about that nitty-gritty, and that's where what Amy had said a little while ago plays into the process really well, is, like, understanding what goes into the day-to-day life of my research, right? So I talked a little bit about my two-photon microscope. I spend, like, a bunch of hours a week sitting in a dark room collecting data, finding out most of its crap, and then resetting and doing it again.
That's a good life, Vinny.
It's a great life.
I want to be a scientist now. The most difficult thing I ever had to communicate was also my own research. Or I used a different example, but from my own lab, exactly because you're in the weeds on it, but also because the work that my lab does is merging two different fields. And so that means to explain a project that my lab is working on, you have to have some knowledge of each of those fields. Mm-hmm. And I was doing this in a sort of 20-minute SITN talk. So we had to go through what is norovirus, what is the most important protein on the surface of norovirus for infecting human cells, how do you model that using physical parameters and, you know, computational methods, and then how do you model the evolution of those viruses using population genetics models? And I that was one of my proudest moments of graduate school, was presenting that work, because, you know, based on the questions I got after that, people understood it, and they were asking really critical questions about the data that I was showing. And so I was like, okay, you know, like that came across, and that was really cool. I still think of that as, like, as I said, I just defended it, but I think that was my most proud moment.
Better or worse than
yeah.
Thesis.
Very proud moment.
Yeah.
Cool. Just so everybody in the room also knows, we have Jessica here, who is an outreach scientist at Agene.
Hi, everyone.
Just to mix it up, same question for you. Most difficult thing you've ever had to explain, and how did you do it?
There are no scientists in my family. I'm the only scientist, and so, which I think in the Boston area especially is somewhat unusual. And so I get a lot of questions about any kind of science, and I guess trying to explain different cancer treatments to my grandmother when she was undergoing breast cancer treatment.
Wow.
was probably the most difficult one. I've never really tried to explain my PhD research to anyone because it was way too obscure, and even to other scientists. But yeah, I would say that was the most difficult one, trying to break that down, and also the situation made it difficult as well. But yeah.
What did she want to or need to understand about the treatments at that time?
So my family is a bit science skeptical, and so she was trying to understand why a treatment that was supposed to make her better was making her feel sick. And so I was talking to her about, you know, how cancer treatments largely these days, even though we're getting a little bit better at it, are trying to knock out the cancer cells before we kill the patient, which I didn't put it quite that way, but just trying to explain this seemingly perverse situation of something that makes you so sick but is treating the cancer. And she's been in remission for over 15 years now, so it did work, and she did understand in the end, and was able to ask her doctor some questions to understand what other additional complementary therapies they were giving her. So I think it was quite successful in the end, but it was difficult.
What would you say is the main difference between communicating with somebody in the general public versus communicating with a peer? And how do you deal with that difference, given that most of the people who are writing for you guys are your peers, are people in science?
Right. Do you want to take that one first?
Yeah. My opinion is that it's actually not that different. So, for example, when Joanne just now was giving me a tour of Agene, she was conscious that, you know, my background is not the typical background of an Agene, you know, scientific employee. So my background is, you know, computational, blah, 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 blah. And she was telling me about how you're trying to control viral titer.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, do you know what titer is? And I was like, not really, you know. So she gave me an example, which is, you know, if you're cooking or you're making a fruit drink out of concentrated pomegranate, you know, pomegranate concentrate versus pomegranate juice, you're going to use different amounts. And so that concentration is akin to the viral titer. That is like the concentration of the virus. Mm-hmm. And so she was talking to me as sort of a lay person, as a non-expert, and she used a comparison or she used a metaphor to help communicate that idea to me. And I think that in general, scientists, you know, can really are starting to focus a lot more on communicating clearly, whether it's to other scientists or whether it's to people who are experts in other fields, or, you know, people who are, you know, sociologists or school teachers, you know, who have a wide variety of backgrounds. And, you know, this comes across really clearly when, you know, I go to, you know, events on campus that are trying to teach me how to get an academic job. You know, if I'm giving an academic job talk where I want to become a professor, the advice that I got recently was anyone with a high school education should be able to understand your presentation, even though you're presenting it to scientists, because the scientists are going to be coming from so many different backgrounds that they can get lost really easily. And your main goal is for them to understand your work. It's really typical for me to go to a lecture and within 3 slides, I'm totally lost, because scientists think that, oh, I'm talking to a scientific audience, so I can pitch it with as much jargon as I want and, you know, with as much specialization as I want. And it just doesn't work really for any audience.
Mm-hmm. Vinny, would you agree that?
I completely agree. Yeah. And in my own personal experience, I would actually say communicating to the general public has been easier than communicating to other scientists,
really?
Whether they're in my discipline or, like, I think the most difficult is to communicate your science to somebody that's, like, on the cusp of your discipline but is not quite in there. So what communicating to the public has actually helped me become a little bit more aware of is, like, not just, okay, this is the data and these are the findings, but this is your audience and this is how, like, these are the things that they value. So come at it from the things that they value and, mm-hmm. and use that to construct your own talks. And for like, after having learned that, I think my conference talks have also become a lot better.
It's interesting that you say the most difficult is the people who are right on the cusp, because I kind of consider that, like, the most dangerous level of knowledge about anything, because you can easily think oversimplify everything based on that small amount of knowledge. So how do you get around that when you're talking to somebody who is just on that cusp?
Ooh. I haven't quite navigated that. It's easier when you're having a conversation. When you're giving a lecture, it's more difficult. You always want to sort of, with scientists, it's tough because you don't want to assume that they don't know that much, but it's always better to just give that background anyway, because there's so much information in people's heads.
Yeah, right? I would agree. So kind of going from the base level is probably the best way to do it, because no matter how many times you've seen something, it's really easy to forget something simple. And I've definitely had times in biology where I've been like, I knew that a long time ago, but I completely forgot that before this talk, and I'm really glad you went over it. Because I probably had some, like, in my head, I could logic it out, and that logicing it out might not be correct all the time. So it's definitely really good to be able to go back to the base facts for stuff. Do you have similar thoughts on that level of knowledge? Like, if you're dealing with somebody who's just on the cusp of a field?
So, I mean, I agree with what both you and Vinny were saying. I think that one difference is that when a scientist gets lost during your talk, they don't think, oh, it's because I don't know enough. You know, it's because science is so hard that I, you know, can't understand it. And I think that one of the, you know, issues when you're talking to somebody who doesn't have a scientific background can be that if they haven't been exposed to science a lot, they might think of it as something that they could never comprehend, mm-hmm. and they assume that they're not going to understand it. So if there is a time that you lose them, that sort of reinforces that idea. Whereas if I get lost in a talk, I'm like, yeah, it's another talk where I got lost. That's so typical.
Yeah.
And I also think that, you know...
And do you try to communicate that to people, more general public
people? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, my grandma is very smart, but she's always saying that she doesn't understand, you know. And I always think, oh, maybe I should do a better job, because I know that you could understand it. You know, I know that you could, and I think it's sort of on me if I want her to understand it to find a way.
Yeah. So what do you actually do during the talk that makes the audience realize you care about their values, that you're actually looking to understand their values during the talk?
Right. So one of the main things is to lay a good foundation with all of the terms that you're going to go through, but also try to use analogies that fit the general world. So cooking analogies are a good one, like the pomegranate syrup and viral titers. And carrying those kinds of things and telling a story, which even as a scientist, as you're writing a paper, constructing a story for another scientist to understand just makes it so much easier when you're reviewing a manuscript. People are more likely to want to be a part of that. And so if you create this story that somebody can easily follow, I think that sort of achieves that point. And one of the interesting parts of that, at least through the processes that we go through, is not that you can get it right the first time. And so one of the things that we try to emphasize when we're going through the preparation of a lecture or the preparation of a blog post is actually a peer review process. So Amy will sit in the audience when I'm trying to practice my lecture. She'll say, "I don't understand that, Vinny. Why don't we go back and think about a different way to explain this such that someone with this background could understand it?" Mm-hmm. And so I think navigating the imperfect process by that peer review process is really, really helpful and almost necessary.
Yeah.
I will say that when we're talking about sort of differences in communicating to scientists and people who aren't practicing scientists, that probably one of the biggest differences, do you know what it's like to do science? And that's why, you know, people are shifting to focusing more on the process, because people are, you know, well, I think that we're finding that anyone can sort of understand, you know, understand the outcome of science, understand, you know, a set of now newly established facts. But, you know, like, I understand probably a lot of what it's like to be an astrophysicist just from, like, my daily routine as a scientist. And that's very different from, you know, being a politician. So I think there is, what I guess what I'm getting at is that there's a culture among scientists that's relatively shared. Mm-hmm. And which is not necessarily accessible to people outside of science. Or, you know, if you've taken high school classes where they say, this is what DNA is, this is what a nucleus is, but you don't understand the process through that. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think we're shifting to sort of communicating process now, part of it. The other thing is exactly what you need to communicate is going to be different whether you're talking to scientists or non-scientists. So, for example, scientists tend to sort of take for granted that vaccines are safe, that climate change is happening, that it's anthropogenic. But people who aren't scientists, you know, might benefit from sort of, for example, one of the people in Science in the News did a program where she was just going through different, I guess, critiques of vaccines and then the evidence that supported those critiques or did not. Mm-hmm. And that was really well received because people just hadn't heard that before.
Right.
And that's not something that you would typically do for scientists, though I'm sure that I would have understood that as well, just because the culture of scientists is that we sort of like accept, you know, whatever is like the sort of consensus among scientists because we trust scientists because we are scientists.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's definitely something that's missing from, like, the general news media, right? Like, once somebody says something, it's just, like, person X or scientist X made this declaration, and this person disagrees with it. And then the story is about how they disagree as opposed to what they're really disagreeing on and what led them to that decision. And so I think that's really an awesome way to really engage people, is to get them to see that side that they don't normally see. And something that you were saying before, too, the like the day-to-day things that you do in the lab, being trying to get people to relate to those is definitely super important. We had somebody in from, I believe it was from Ghana, who was talking about how he had never done like a
PCR.
Yeah, he'd never done a PCR before. He'd never cloned before, and he thought it was like insanely difficult. But once you actually see what somebody's doing in the lab when they're doing that, really anybody can do that. It's not hard. What your hands are doing is not a difficult process. In getting that across to people and seeing that our lives are actually like kind of mundane in a lot of ways, I think makes science a lot more approachable than people would normally think of it.
In terms of the purpose of science communication, one point that I wanted to put out there is that I think that the purpose of SciComm is traditionally for scientists to whatever educate the public, you know, that's usually how it's put. But I think, and this is something that we've sort of been talking about here, that one of the really important aspects is actually for scientists to be able to educate each other, because, you know, I am the lay audience for many scientists, for somebody doing quantum computing, you know, for somebody doing like hardcore molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
And as scientists apparently are becoming more and more specialized, we need still to understand what other scientists are doing. And that means that either the scientists need to be doing communicating their findings to other scientists, and also that I rely a lot on journalists to actually understand what other scientists are doing, because I just can't read their papers, and I don't have time to read their papers.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I wanted to say too, is I keep saying the general public. We are the general public too. So like you said, I don't understand anything in an astrophysics paper any more than an accountant understands what's going on in a biology paper. Is there any other like number one mistake that you think scientists make when communicating with the general public or with people who aren't in their field?
I'm not sure if this is a mistake necessarily in the like actual communication or the thought process of it. So I think a lot of scientists approach science communication or conceptualize it as a didactic process where you are lecturing.
What is didactic mean?
No jargon, Jenny.
No jargon. So as you are, you know, sitting in a like a very academic, like you're sitting in a classroom explaining a topic to somebody,
mm-hmm.
which really isn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
And
it can be very boring.
It can be very, very boring in that sense. And you can also be engaging. And some people, some communicators are very talented at being able to make something very boring sound very exciting,
mm-hmm.
but others aren't as gifted. But I think the main thing is that we have to understand as science communicators, we shouldn't think about it as if we are talking down to somebody or lecturing somebody, but rather engaging them in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you might be an expert in one topic, but an accountant is an expert in
accounting,
right? and you have to understand them as experts in those topics that could potentially be helpful to you and those kinds of perspectives. And the types of, when you approach science communication in that fashion, I think you get a lot more out of it. So, for example, when I'm giving a Science in the News lecture and I'm able to have a conversation with somebody in the audience about what I work on, and they ask me a really cool question about something that I had never thought about before, I'm like, well, I think I have done my job because I've engaged in conversation with them and I've made them feel like I'm also a human being that they can talk to.
We've been sort of extolling the value of sort of science in a social context.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there are people who just want to understand the technologies, and that's valuable too, as you said. Like, you know, a fact is valuable too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, science communicators are going to want to like balance over the next few years these different ways of doing science communication.
Yeah, I think I would argue that a lot of these we're looking at Boston. If we're talking about the Museum of Science in Boston,
yeah.
like
yeah.
you are getting a self-selecting crowd, and I think a lot of the data that's out there is from self-selecting crowds.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the question is, we're identifying these pockets where you don't have people that are like actively interested in going to these things, or maybe just don't know about those. So how can we reach those pockets?
Right. Yeah.
So I think one sort of necessitates the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so there will probably be a little bit more research on how that happens.
And where would you say to go to find that research?
There's like a Public Understanding of Science journal,
mm-hmm.
And the PCST network. But anybody that's involved with the PCST network,
what does PCST stand for?
Public Communication of Science and Technology. And so they include countries that are like all through Africa, all through Europe, Australia, New Zealand. Not so much the Americas, which is really funny. So they. They have a lot of communications on their website, and if you reach out to some of the individual professors, they're
mm-hmm.
quite cool to talk to. But I don't know if there's like one journal. You might know a little bit better because you do STS.
The ones that you mentioned, also
yeah.
I'll throw out there that the Association for the Advancements, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, sorry, they're like, that's AAAS, but there are multiple AAASs, so I get confused sometimes, has a logic module on their site for communication, science communication through various modes, the different modes that we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of the theory behind why they propose those modes.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
We hope that this episode helped to demystify some aspects of science communication and encourage you to get out there and start doing some science communication of your own. Next time, we'll give advice on how to start an organization like Science in the News. Until then, thanks for listening to the Agene Podcast, a better way to share science.